come along with us as we explore the broad world of preservation and the work being done to preserve, interpret, and save our past in a 21st century world. From aquaculture to historic foodways to forensic modeling, we're talking weekly with experts from across the globe. This is your host, Nick Redding. Welcome to PreserveCast. This is Nick Redding, and you're listening to PreserveCast. And today, we're excited to have a return guest. We're speaking with Andrew Rowand, who, in addition to his day job of being the curator and site administrator at the Eric Sloan Museum, is also an accomplished shoemaker. And we're going to be talking about the recreation of historic shoes and the work that he puts into that as sort of a an homage to a historic trade and one that he continues to practice. But before we get there, as a reminder, we've already spoken with Andrew once before about the Eric Sloan Museum. For those who don't remember, who was Eric Sloan and where exactly do you work, Andrew?
Yeah, that's a great question. Eric Sloan was an American author and artist, and he is really well known for cataloging and writing about and preserving early American trades and crafts, not only through his writings, but also his illustrations. And in the 1960s, he helped found a museum in Northwest Connecticut in a little town called Kent. And it has an astounding collection of early American tools and is really a gathering place for people interested in early trades and crafts. So I feel very fortunate to have been there the last 4 years.
And he did beautiful paintings, beautiful sketches, also somewhat cantankerous, and is a fascinating character. And I had the chance to visit the museum this past summer. It's beautiful, and definitely commend everyone to go do that. And what a perfect place for somebody who also loves early trade and craft. I'm sure Eric, well, I'm not so sure. You can't say which way Eric would have fallen on anything, but I imagine he would have been pleased to know that you actually could work with your hands. That was a big thing for him. So, you know, we're going to dive into this. I feel like it might have been when we were up there last time that you mentioned, oh, yeah, you know, I'm finishing up, or you were coming to an event that we were hosting, finishing up some, you know, collection of like 12 historic shoes or something like that. And I've got to like get them out tonight. And I'm like, wait, you also just as like a side gig are making shoes? And you're like, yeah. So how does someone might wonder when hearing that, how does someone get into historic shoemaking? Because your background, tell people like where you grew up, you went to school, you didn't go to cobbling or cord waning school to get your degree. You went to Shepherd. And so talk to us about your sort of your background and then how you get into this.
Yeah, it's a it's an interesting just twist and turns really. I grew up in North Central West Virginia and in a little town called Grafton. I had no connection to shoemaking at all. I come from a family of tradespeople and craftspeople, so that idea of working with your hands and creating art that way was always really inspiring. And when I moved to the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia to attend Shepherd, I had really started to dive into historic tailoring as part of growing up and volunteering at museums and working in museums and getting interested in historic costuming. And then I really just fell in love with the idea of learning how to make shoes, or I became really interested in it. Because when you first look at a shoe, it's kind of like looking at a house or a structure. You're like, how does all of this come together? How, you know, there's so many parts that you can't see that make up this, you know, this object. So I just became fascinated with how they worked and just became really fortunate enough to be connected with several shoemakers and one who took me under his wing, and I started apprenticing with him over a decade ago now, which is wild.
So that's and just like in the historic period, that's the best way to learn, I presume, is by apprenticing. So where does the apprenticeship happen? Was it just sort of an informal thing, or did it happen as a part of work?
Yeah. So it happened as an informal side hobby. I was working for the Maryland Park Service at the time at South Mountain State Battlefield, and just really interested in 19th century material culture. And a friend of mine reached out and said, there's this guy in Richmond, Virginia, who's been a shoemaker for 40 years, and you should chat with him. So this is 2013, 2012, 2013 time range. And we actually started corresponding by email at first, and then over the phone. And he would send me information and research about 19th century shoes, just to get an idea and understanding. And then I would travel down to Richmond from West Virginia every couple months and do some hands-on practice. And then with the history world, you know, moving around to museums and finding job opportunities, I'm going to use this a lot. I've been really fortunate, and I say that a lot, but it's true. I was able to get a museum job full time in Richmond. It wasn't planned that way. It just happened to be that's where my mentor was. So I continued that apprenticeship with him in person. And I worked with him about every week for 5 years until moving up here to Connecticut. So it's been a really great experience because, like you said, it is a historic method almost of learning from a master of their craft. Of course, there's other ways. Some people do go to shoemaking schools and cordwainer colleges. And of course, there's classes and things like that folks can take if they're interested. But yeah, having that kind of historic setting for it was very nice.
Historic without the having to live like in his attic or something like that. So that was kind of a nice touch for those people who are familiar with apprenticeships. Sometimes that was required and you had to stay away from the family and things like that. And I think it's important too, because I think a lot of people, like, you know, you have an Instagram account. I think it's Old Timey Nonsense, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
So that's people can find you there. but I think a lot of times people can look at people doing craft, and your wife also, who we've had on the show, on the podcast, is an accomplished artist. In fact, I have some right over my shoulder right there. a print that she made. But you know, I think sometimes people look at that stuff and they're like, wow, they're just either inherently skilled or it must have just come easy. They picked that up quickly, you know, wow, like that's so cool. But I think it's also important to recognize that it took a lot of time to get to where you're at, that, you know, that what you said there, you apprenticed and you were with somebody once a week for 5 years. That's more time than some of us spend with close family. Like that's, you know, so that's a serious commitment. But you don't have to, but by any chance, do you want to say his name just so people know who was this master behind the scenes?
Yeah, absolutely. His name is James Myers. He goes by Butch, but he's been a shoemaker for over 40 years in the Richmond area, doing historic reproduction and historic research. So you said spending more time than you do with, you know, with family sometimes. And it is true. And I feel like with, especially in trades and crafts, that mentor and, you know, apprentice kind of situation, you do become very close with that person because they are taking that time to pass on that trade and skill to you, which is just a really amazing gift. And the amount of time that goes into it, I think that's something that I always try to remember is no matter how many years I've been doing this, I'm never going to be where I want to be with it. There's always more to learn. There's always more to practice. And it does take dedication to just stay with it. There's always more to learn and improve on. So there's never a dull moment with it.
So people might be curious if they're familiar with the apprenticeship model. It sounds like Butch is probably a master. I mean, if you've been doing it that long, hopefully at that point you are. Are you a journeyman now, would you say, or are you a master?
I would not say I'm a master. I would definitely say I'm a journeyman. And I know when when my wife hears this, she's always like, no, you're moving, you know, you've always got to hype yourself up, which is true. I can make shoes. That's the way I like to put it. But, I feel really lucky to have come. I've got to meet Butch's mentor. So his master that he studied under. So I'm part of this lineage of passing down this knowledge. So it's kind of the agreement of when I hit that point where I feel like I can take on a student and I can pass on what I'm learning in a competent way to help someone else in their career. That's when I feel like I will have reached that master aspect of when I can take someone on and be the next link in that chain of passing on this knowledge.
And you're not there yet. So if somebody's hanging out in rural Connecticut who's like, I just got to make shoes. You could, right? You must have some knowledge to impart.
Oh yeah. And, you know, and again, it's kind of that over humbling West Virginia background. I would love to start teaching. Right now I'm well past making 100 pairs of shoes at this point. I think last year I did, 38 pairs of shoes. So it's, definitely making them and working towards that point. So that's kind of, I feel like I'm in that phase of my, experience with the craft and the trade that I can really start looking at that, diving into more in-depth research of how some of these practices were done and kind of reaching out more than just in my own shop.
So for somebody listening who's like, maybe they've seen a Civil War reenactment or they're aware that such a thing exists, but aren't terribly familiar with a historic shoe or why they're any different than a modern shoe. I mean, obviously, talking about construction of a shoe, it would be better in a visual medium than an audio. I mean, so we're not going to go step by step through explaining all these different pieces because people listening aren't going to care about the vamp and all these different things. Like, it's not going to make any sense when we're just talking about it. It's one of those tactile things. But talk to us just about the process of making one, just sort of broadly defined, and why it's important to get it right and kind of maybe what you bring to the table versus what something that came from overseas would be, what's the difference? We'll talk about it, but it demands a high price too. These are not cheap shoes.
Yeah. Those are all, great questions. So my work, I work primarily from the 17th century to the late 19th century, as far as how shoes are made, with a primary focus in the 19th century. So I'll kind of stick there, I guess. The shoes are primarily made of leather, or they are all made of leather. So within this, you have a leather sole that's making contact with the ground. And then you have leather pieces that cover your foot, which are called the vamp and quarter. So back near the heel and what's covering your toe. And all of that is bound to a leather piece inside called an insole. And there's a couple different ways that this can be attached. It can be done through a welted method. Boots are still being made welted today. It's a thin strip of leather that attaches the top that covers your toes to the sole, which is covering that bottom of your foot, and a line of stitching that goes around there. And that was primarily the method until the 19th century. Shoes had to be stitched to be closed. And then starting the 19th century, you start to see work of wooden pegs being used to hold that sole to the shoe itself. So almost like a wooden nail that's driven in to attach the sole to the rest of the shoe. And that's something that is still carried over today in Western bootmaking traditions, cowboy bootmaking. But as far as why it kind of matters for historic reproduction, as far as living history programs and material culture, of course, we want visitors or patrons to see as clear of detail as we can possibly do what the material culture of the past looked like. And part of that is getting each detail correct in the making. So as part of that, I use leathers that are of historic weights and tannages, mostly vegetable tanned leathers, like historic examples that have also been stuffed with wax and oils to make them more supple and water resistant, all the way down to the tools that I'm using, which I would say about 95% of my tools are historic tools that are being used today just the same way they were designed to be used 150, 175 years ago.
Stop you there for a second. Where people might be curious, where do you get the historic vegetable tan leathers? Is that more challenging? Are there options? Is it becoming difficult to source that? Where do you find that stuff?
Yeah, so there are a couple US-based tanneries that will work with vegetable tan leathers. And then, of course, you can go down to your kind of big box stores, like something like Tandy or reaching out to Weaver, that still provide vegetable tan leathers. It is getting a little bit difficult to source what's during the period would be called wax calf or wax kips. These are simply leathers that have been permeated with oils and waxes to make them water resistant and supple. So that it's a little bit of a challenge to do that because there's not a high demand for that kind of leather today. So using historic documents and examples, much like you would look up for home restoration, historic paint recipes. In the 18th and 19th century, there are written examples of how these practices will be done, and recreating that in-house to try to recreate that. So I'll start with a piece of vegetable tan leather, which is just leather that has been tanned for preservation and is that natural kind of brown tannish color. And then we'll start with coloring it with various coloring options. Usually natural or black are very common colors. And then infusing it with oils and waxes, just layer after layer until it gets to the consistency that I want.
Now, for somebody who...
Sorry, I don't know if that actually answered the question.
No, it does. It does. I think it's helpful. So for somebody, like, who is the average customer? Is it an institution? Are they individuals? And let's say it is an individual, do they get measured, or do they just tell you, here's what my shoe size is? How do you actually take it from order to completion?
So I've taken orders for institutions, for individuals. Primarily it is individual orders. And I work making each pair bespoke to the customer's measurements. So it is not an off-the-rack size like we would expect today to just go into a store. And I think that's something that we're also common, or it's so common for us to think about just going into a shoe store and getting a size 9 or a size 10. But historically, those sizes that we use today are not the same standards that would have been used in the past. So what I try to do is physically measure the customer or client in person if I can. And that has obviously become challenging over the past few years, and something that as my clientele is growing, it's harder to get out to someplace like California to measure someone's feet from Connecticut. So I have a series of measurement charts that I send out. And what folks will do, will take these measurements step by step. So what I get back from them are tracings and specific measurements of their foot that I then take. Building a shoe, there is a wooden form that you're nailing all of the leather to and sewing all the leather to, that's called a last. And for the listener, it's just a wooden form in the shape of a foot or of that shoe. So it will ultimately take that form, that the finished product. And what I'll do is I will add or take away places on that last to to match the customer's measurements. So if they have wider feet, I'll add on to the last. If there's something more narrow, I will work on a smaller pattern. So everything is custom made.
And it seems to me like the last and the pattern are pretty critical here, because I mean, the idea of putting a shoe together is, whether it's a historic shoe or it's a modern shoe, depending on the tools you use and the methods, but it's going to take the form and shape of the last that is used. So if you want it to look like a mid 18th century shoe, that's going to be a different last than a modern one. Are you using all historic? I can't imagine that you're using an 18th century last, like an original last, but maybe you are. And what if you need, like, what about, like, you know, people didn't have gargantuan feet in the 19th century. So like a really big last, do you have to make your own? Do you carve them? Does it then it sort of involve the wood skills? Like, how does that all play out?
Yeah. So I guess I'll start in the beginning. The last is critical. It is everything to how the final shoe is going to look. But also the height of the heel. I know the listener can't see, but I have a wooden last that is made off of a historic example. So this is a copy made off of a surviving 18th century style last. It is made of maple, very hard wood. And the toe shape is very pointed, almost like a modern, what we consider a roper toe today on a boot. And a shoemaker historically would not have been the one turning these lasts or carving these lasts. In some cases they would, but when you're operating a business, typically you're going to be reaching out to someone who does have those wood skills that you might not. Hmm. I think we all like to think of the past as these tradespeople being Jack and Jills of all trades. You know, they can do everything, but when it comes down to it, time is money. So if someone else has those better wood skills than you do, you're going to reach out to them. And as a shoemaker, more than likely you'd reach out to someone who could carve a last for you, this shape of the foot. And then that would just be part of your shop inventory that you would build your shoes off of. And as time goes on, we move from this kind of pointed toe to kind of a rounder toe, to a square toe, back to a pointed toe. So depending on what time period of shoe I'm recreating, we're looking at different profiles of that last. So how high the heel is going to be, how pointed the toe is going to be, how high it rises on the ankle. And it's also looking at, if I need a size 9, roughly a size 9 shoe in modern standards, I need a last that's roughly size 9. And then when you look at more bespoke work, like real, you know, high-end shoemaking for dress shoes and Oxfords today, a lot of those firms and artisans are going to be looking at getting last made custom to that person's foot. So when you reorder for them, they have a last that is just your measurements. And I'm not there yet, but
that's about as bespoke as it gets. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, the only thing more that they could do is wear the shoe for you at that point. Absolutely. So how many, I'm just out of curiosity, how many lasts do you own now?
I'm really fortunate that I'm in a business with my mentor and working with some of his lasts, some of my own lasts. So in the kind of collective library, we have, I would say, close to 200 now of different sizes and styles.
And who makes those for you? Is there a last maker that you work with?
Yeah, so there's a variety of places. There are, if we need wooden last, we'll go to folks that either specialize in making wooden lasts, if they're, which are getting few and far between. But a lot of these are turned on lathes today, like grading lathes. You can also reach out to more modern firms that are still making lasts for modern shoe production. And those are going to, instead of being made in wood, you can request that, but a lot of the places are using the self-healing plastics for their lasts. So when we can, we like to stay in the wooden forms, not only because of the historical aspect of it, but if we're going out and doing a program or teaching right. a class, you would want it to be in wood rather than in the plastics, but they serve the same purpose. So there's still places making them.
Are those modern firms 3D printing them?
Some are. There are some companies that are experimenting with 3D printing their last, but a lot of them are turning them out of plastic stock. So it's there's a couple places in Mexico that are still making lasts that you can reach out to, and they will you can send them patterns and what or examples and what you're looking to have made, and they'll make you from a size, you know, one all the way up to, you know, 20 if you wanted. So it's neat that that's still an option.
And I ask about the cost here, because then maybe we'll get towards what someone could expect to pay for a handmade shoe. But like, what is the cost of a last? I mean, it doesn't sound cheap to the whole process here.
Maybe yeah, I'm wrong. It all depends on the material, who's making it. But typically, you're looking at over $100 per form. Now, of course, you can find used ones in different styles. When it gets into more modern shoemaking terms, that's a little easier. But for your historic examples, per last, you're looking at $100 to $150, maybe $200 per last. And it gets into the weeds, because a lot of times you can't just have one made. You have to have a full run from size 1 to size 13 or whatever made. So it is quite an investment that goes into it.
But it sounds like you're at a point with your tools and with your lasts that you probably have most of the time what you need. Like, you're not going out and searching out lasts to make a set of, you know, Revolutionary War era shoes, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So I'm always looking to expand. So I, you know, have some feelers out now about getting some other styles made to incorporate different aspects of various shoe construction. But kind of that idea of reusing and repurposing, I think we've all been to an antique store and have seen, you know, a pair of a wooden shoe form in there that someone has either tried to make into a lamp, or it's a book stand or something. So a lot of times I will save those if they're usable. And if I need to alter them to use them, I can do that. So I do work off of historic examples. If that piece is sound enough that it's not going to harm it by using it. So
for people listening, how long does it take to make a pair? I guess you could tell us the historic time period, and then current, you know, with real life and everything getting in the way. And then if you're comfortable sharing it, like, what is the average cost? You know, if somebody says, I really want a pair of super cool bespoke mid-19th century shoes just to wear around, which I'm sure that happens. Then talk to us about that. So timing, you know, what in the historic period and the modern period, and then costs.
Yeah, the historic period, especially in the 19th century, starting here in New England, you're going to be seeing a system where you're not having typically not one person is making the shoe. It's going to be an assembly line of sorts, where a shoe shop will source out to the community the uppers, or the part that's going to be covering the top of your foot. They will contract women in the community to sew those in their homes as piecework. And then as those pieces are completed, they'll be brought back to the shoe shop, where a group of shoemakers we'll be working to last that upper and stretch that leather that the women have closed over that wooden block and attach the soling to it. So you're still looking at multiple hours in this process, 15 plus hours per pair. Today we're working primarily I'm doing all of it, from cutting out the pieces to sewing them to closing them, doing the finish work on it. And for a pegged shoe, peg construction, again, those wooden nails that are holding it together, you're looking at about 15 to 20 hours, and then more if you're looking at hand sewing that shoe, which takes more time than driving the wooden nails in the sole. So, of course, with that, cost goes up, because again, time is money. Material costs are like everything going up, which is something that's can keep it a little price prohibitive at times. So right now, for my baseline shoes, you're looking at about $425 for a peg construction shoe. So kind of the plain, not plain Jane, I shouldn't say, but the baseline models. And then as you're moving forward, as stitching goes forward, the price is going to increase. Of course, boots, a Wellington pull-on boot is going to be much more than something like an ankle boot or a shoe, just for material cost and time. So it's definitely not as easy is going online and getting something imported. There are firms that are making these shoes mechanically from all over the world. But it's something that you're getting a shoe that is made to your exact measurements and standing by that work that it's not going to, you know, blow apart on your foot while you're wearing it. At least knock on wood, hasn't happened yet.
What's the demand? You said you made 30 some odd shoes last year. Is that a lot? Is that too much? Is that just where you can barely keep up? Or are you going to be, you know, bringing in someone from the community to tie things together? Does your wife get involved in this? Like, what, how much is the, and I guess then sort of on, as a follow on to that, like, what's the timeline? Like, if somebody were to order a shoe today, when would they get it?
Yeah. So the demand is quite high. The historic, the living history community, institutions, they're all looking for kind of the most accurate pieces they can get. And I'm very fortunate to stay busy. I'm at the point where my books right now are filled all the way until November. You know, I can take smaller pieces here and there, but I try to plan out.
So doing we're recording this on Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
And you said your books are filled through November. So that means if someone, you have your year planned out of shoemaking all the way through November.
Yeah. I try to schedule in those larger projects that are going to be more time consuming that way. And then throughout the year, if I'm looking to, if there's a style that I'm, you know, really interested in making or just too impatient to make, I will make those alongside of other ones that I'm making. So there's always multiple shoes in progress in the shop. Hmm. So I stay very busy. I'm very fortunate for that. And sometimes I do have to step back and say, oh, I do need to sleep at some time. And remember that it isn't the you know, it's not supposed to be a full-time job, but it's very rewarding. And I'm actually looking at becoming less of a Luddite and mechanizing a little bit, not necessarily to speed up the time or alter the process of the making, but to look at making more modern footwear. And kind of doing modern twists on historic styles.
Yeah, I think there'd be a lot of interest in that and, you know, being able to come out and see your shop and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Do you have a favorite style of shoe to make?
I do. So I really like making ankle boots. They are one of the first things I ever made. And I always love going back to making those. And interestingly enough, I've found a, outside of the kind of living history reenacting community with that, still that historic preservation idea, a lot of timber framers, a lot of historic carpenters have reached out about getting footwear inspired by historic examples. So whether it be a Wellington boot, you know, pull on two-piece boot or an ankle boot, I've actually been, they're steadily rising in numbers. So thank you to timber framers out there that, you know, have a fashion for, or a passion for fashion or something like that, I guess, you know, they're a well-dressed bunch.
That's awesome. Well, before we go, in years past, we've asked people about their favorite historic place or site. We've already done that for quite some time, and we certainly are done it with you. And if I know you, I'm guessing I know that you're probably reading something historic right now. So we were going to start asking folks about what they're currently reading or what they've recently read in the genre of history that they think others might be interested in.
Yeah, right now I have really fallen down a rabbit hole. I guess this isn't a really a historic writing one per se, but I've recently been collecting and cataloging concealed shoes that have been found in early New England homes here, and reading more into the tradition of concealing shoes in inside of walls of houses, and looking at all the places and styles that that shows up. So I've been really passionate about that, because a lot of these shoes that are, as houses are being remodeled or if they're being deconstructed, there are these shoes that have just been encapsulated in the wall, you know, since someone put them in there. And they give us a really great snapshot of what everyday people were wearing in those time periods and how those shoes were constructed, rather than going to a museum, which oftentimes will have very high-end, very showy pieces of historic examples that not everyday people might have been wearing. So I've been working on that for the last couple months, and it's just been a really rewarding process. So I'm looking forward to diving more into that and hopefully writing some things on some of these findings.
Cool. Well, if for people who want to get in touch with you, or maybe they want to get on your, at this point, maybe your 2025 list for a pair of shoes, what's the best place to find you and engage with you?
Yeah. So the best way, I'm still working on getting a good website up and running. Again, that Luddite mentality. I got to get up with the times here. But I try to keep my Instagram pretty up to date with what's happening. That's, you can just search my name, Andrew Rowand, or it's Old Timey Nonsense, all one word. I can share my contact information as well if there's show notes or something like that.
Yeah, and people can contact us, and we can always connect the two of you and get you in line for a pair of ankle boots for your next timber framing opportunity. Well, this has been fun. It's always cool to have you back. I'm sure we'll uncover something else about you in the future that you make. I know you do belts and all those sorts of things. So anything leather yeah. that you can do. We didn't get into that. Belts a little bit simpler than shoes. So we focused yeah. on the high value item there. But it's fun to talk with somebody who's keeping this alive, and also to point out that there's high demand for this sort of thing, that it is not a It's not really a dying. It might be in that there's fewer people doing it, but there's still a lot of interest and huge demand in it, and exciting to see people getting engaged. Always fun to have you on and chat with you about this and the work that you're doing up there in Connecticut.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always a great time.
Thanks for listening to PreserveCast. To dig deeper into this episode's story, head over to preservecast.org for show notes and our collection of previous episodes. Don't forget to engage with this podcast by subscribing, commenting, and leaving a review. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at PreserveCast for even more. PreserveCast is currently recorded in Walkersville, Maryland, and sponsored by the 1772 Foundation and powered by Preservation Maryland. Thanks for listening, and keep on preserving.